From Portland, Oregon, back for a second season, this is the Jewish Review Podcast. I'm Rocky Roll. Coming up this episode, the month of Elul, leading up to the high holidays, is a time in the Jewish calendar infused with its own special meaning. To dig deeper into the purpose of Elul, I spoke with Rabbi Josh Rose, the founder of Kolab here in Portland. We get into some practices tied to this month that can bring meaning to high holiday preparation, even for the least religious among us, as well as texts associated with this time and the value of studying Jewish text in the modern world. Welcome back to all of our returning listeners, and hello to our new fans in the making. Stay with us. The Jewish Review Podcast is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, presenting the Mitzvah Project and Mitzvah Makers, partnering with Portland Backpack for a day of volunteer service Sunday, September 15th, for young adults and families with young children. Learn more about this hands-on opportunity to make the world a little better online at jewishportland.org/themitzvahproject and jewishportland.org/mitzvahmakers. Now here's Rabbi Josh Rose. Rabbi Josh Rose, welcome to the Jewish Review Podcast.
So glad to be here. Thanks, Rockney, for having me.
Thanks for coming. So tell me about your Jewish journey.
Oh, man, that's a big and great question. I love it. My Jewish journey, well, I grew up here in Portland, Oregon. My Abba, my father of blessed memory, is Rabbi Emanuel Rose, who was for 46 years the rabbi at Congregation Beth Israel. And so I'm in some ways a child of the Reform Jewish movement, and in some ways I'm not. And what I mean by that is, you know, growing up, my father really instilled in me a sense of kind of the public nature of Jewish values. For him, it was, and for many Reform Jewish leaders of his time, it was the prophetic Jewish tradition that guided Jews into trying to articulate the kind of American society we needed to live in and to focus on questions of justice. And that part of the Reformed tradition always really seemed foundational to me, to being a Jew in the modern world. But there were other aspects of Reform that didn't make sense to me when I was little. And as I got older, even though I went into Reform seminary, I started to kind of gravitate towards a much deeper interest in observance, you know, mitzvah, the idea of mitzvah, kashrut, and Shabbat observance. So I didn't grow up with that stuff, but I gravitated towards it kind of naturally. And as I went through rabbinical school, there was this strange dynamic happening, which is that on the one hand, I was coming closer and closer over time to becoming a Reform rabbi, but I also was becoming closer and closer to beginning to live like some version of probably conservative Judaism. And, even when I was in rabbinical school, the places I most liked to daven or to pray were actually Orthodox, modern Orthodox synagogues. And I was ordained in 07, and I served a congregation in Boulder, a Reformed Jewish congregation. And over my time there, magnificent group of people, beautiful place, it was all good. But I was starting to really, you know, make decisions in my own life, and my family was making decisions in our lives, practically speaking, as conservative Jews, like literally using conservative Jewish halakha. And then all of this went along with like a very deep spiritual yearning. It wasn't just about halakha. It was like really, really trying to find a connection to divinity and to fill my life with spirituality. And I came to Portland in 07. So as I had been on this trajectory to become essentially like a conservative rabbi without the ordination. And it happened that Sheri Torah, Congregation Sheri Torah, had been for some years moving in a direction that was more along the line of the conservative movement. They, having been Orthodox sometime before, they officially became conservative a few years before I arrived. And there was this crazy opening where it just kind of fit. And it made sense. A Portland rabbi who wanted to kind of change things up, for, saw some opportunities in Jewish life, wanted to live in the conservative Jewish world. It was magnificent. I love the congregation. Beautiful people. Couldn't have been more supported by them. A lot of great energy. Very, very, very special place to me. And then to my own astonishment, sometime around 2020, I just started to have, I don't want to call it a crisis of religious faith because it didn't feel like a crisis. Mm-hmm. There was no rending of garments or, you know, screaming into the void or anything like that. But I just began to find it harder and harder to be an observant Jew. My wife and I were having conversations, and that certainly resonated with her. And so, much to my surprise, I got to the point where I thought, you know, this congregation needs and deserves a rabbi who can embrace halakha and the vision of conservative Judaism in a way that I no longer can. They deserve to have a rabbi who was the person I was when I got here. So with a lot of warmth and heartache, I tendered my resignation, thankfully for them, because they came out of the deal with an awesome rabbi, and Rabbi Gary Oren. And I founded CoLab. And so I'm kind of now, I feel like I'm at the beginning of a chapter of my life as a Jewish person, which feels pretty great at my age to be, you know, having a new beginning.
Yeah. Tell me about some of the work that, for our listeners who might not know as well as I, perhaps, some of the work that CoLab has done and is doing in Portland.
So CoLab, kind of out of the gate, our goal was really to bring people together to dream and to envision and to manifest the Jewish future right here in Portland. That was the idea. Get people together. What do you want? What do you think Jewish life could look like? What do we want to be talking about? What should we be gathering about? Through a bunch of individual conversations with largely younger and unaffiliated Jews across the city, really, we just made events and programs out of people's dreams. That included a conference on Judaism and psychedelics, which people always laugh at, but it was actually quite a kind of sober, no pun intended, examination of the issues involved in Jewish spirituality and intergenerational Jewish trauma and the efficacy of psychedelics. We did an event on food and Jewish values, where we brought together all these incredible food vendors talking about food ethics and all kinds of things. So we did things like that. We also, the feather in our cap, one of the programs that we're most proud of is something that Shoshana Guggenheim-Kedem and I started together, which is called Art Lab, which is a cohort program for contemporary Jewish artists. We've had some phenomenal Jewish artists coming, artists who are Jewish, I should say, because most of their work is not necessarily Jewish in content, coming together to establish creative Jewish community, to learn together. We do a lot of text study in there, and to explore Jewish identity and values in a contemporary context. And then we just did, we've done all kinds of different programs. We threw Portland's biggest, insanest Purim party. 350 people get together for a night of celebration and amusement, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But now, starting September 3rd, and I think this podcast is coming out September 4th, if I'm not mistaken, you told me.
That is correct.
We're starting something called Learning Lab, which is where people will come together over chef-prepared meals. Sonia Sanford, who's an incredibly talented chef and writer, is going to be cooking meals. People come together, and then they go to learn with one of any number of phenomenal teachers. Right now, our teaching staff is Dr. Natan Meir from PSU, Dr. Yosef Rosen, who probably a lot of people in Portland don't yet know about, but is an incredible teacher of Kabbalah. Rabbi Devin Villarreal, incredible teacher connected to Hadar nationally, like as a teacher of teachers. And Rabbi Emily Kapper-Mater, who people might know from Portland's Open Beit Midrash. And I will also be a teacher. And we'll have an artist in residence at every program. So people who want to go explore ideas and actually work with an artist can do that. So that's weekly, every Tuesday night, starting September 3rd.
That sounds beautiful. Speaking of Jewish culture and ideas, we're starting the month in the Hebrew calendar of Elul. What is the significance of this month?
Oh, man, Elul is such a rich, beautiful time. I don't know that there's, I'm not sure there's anything else like it in religious life. Elul is so important because it is the month leads up to Rosh Hashanah. And if you grew up in Jewish life, as many of us did, I think there was the sense of like you walk into synagogue on Rosh Hashanah and you're like, I know I'm supposed to feel something and I know I'm supposed to be working on things because everyone's talking about teshuva or repentance. But, oh, man, I just walked in the door and how do I start this? Well, really, the way it's supposed to work is the month of Elul, which starts a month before Rosh Hashanah, is this month of, I don't know, to use an overused cliche in contemporary therapeutic culture, it's a month of inner work, basically. It's a month of exploring who am I, where am I trying to go, What have I done in this past year that I can learn from, I need to make amends for? What are the opportunities for becoming the person I need to be in this world in the coming years? And so really the idea is by the time you walk in on Rosh Hashanah, you've already been doing, you know, at least 30 days of intense inner exploration and reflection. And so you walk in and you have a sense of, I have my list. I'm aware of the things I need to be reflecting on and looking at through the lens of these prayers. So it's a magnificent time of it's intense and it's powerful and it's rich just to set aside this time.
Yeah. What are some of the practices that traditionally come with this month?
Let me talk about a practice that I want to make sure to offer people, because I think is so powerful. And also, this is one that I think that even for people who don't approach the Jewish tradition with a strong sense of religiosity or spirituality, I would hate for anyone to think that they couldn't benefit from this profound period of self-reflection. And so let me give a couple of practices that are very practical and within reach of everybody. There's a tradition of journaling and doing a self-reflective period of journaling, because for some people, just thinking about like, well, what did I do last year that I want to change? That's very hard. But if you commit stuff to paper, it forces you to think. You know, don't say I'm going to journal for an hour today. If you have a thought about, all right, let me review. I had this fight with my brother last year, and I'm going to sit down and write about that for 5 minutes or whatever, 10 minutes. So that's one thing. The other thing, which comes to us from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, and people who listen to my podcast, which is called The Genesis, may have heard an interview I did with Rabbi Gabriel Goldfeder, who's a friend of mine, Orthodox rabbi, a friend of mine, who talked about this practice of from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, which Rabbi Nachman calls Hitbodedut, which means, I don't know how to translate the word, but it means something like, active solitude or engaged solitude. But practically what Hitbodedut is Rabbi Nachman would literally just wander the forest, and he counseled his students to wander in the forest and talk out loud to God, just spontaneous prayer. Now, asterisk for people who are listening who don't do that and don't have a theology. That's okay. I mean, Rabbi Nachman might not have said it's okay, but maybe he would have. But the point is to speak spontaneously. When I say speak, I mean literally. So it's going to feel weird to those of you who have never done anything like this before, because you're walking around talking to yourself quite literally. Mm-hmm. So for Rabbi Nachman, it would be Hashem or God. I'm so frustrated about this, and I'm in this conflict with my wife, and you just keep talking and pouring it out. And that self-revelation can bring you to a place of very deep honesty if you're authentic and you stay in it. And you can really uncover thoughts and emotions and feelings and insights that you might not otherwise. And so if you're uncomfortable addressing a God and you don't believe in God, I still think that this practice can be quite therapeutic. Many of us have been fortunate enough to have the experience of speaking with a therapist, but even with a therapist, there's a level of self-consciousness because you're speaking with another person. You find yourself just speaking in the deepest honesty that you yourself can handle. It's a very powerful way to get down to the core of what are the most important things in your life that you'll need to focus on this Rosh Hashanah.
Unfortunately,
so those are two practices that I recommend.
Fortunately, here in Portland, we are well equipped for that with our parks and forest space.
Yeah, that's right. Well, increasingly, it's harder to find a space where no one's going to bump up against you. I grew up here, and I used to hang out in Forest Park, Lower McClay Park, and you could spend hours there and not come across anybody. And now you can't. But certainly, somewhere, if there's a city where you can be alone in a park, it's this place. Yeah.
What is the purpose of the blowing of the shofar in the mornings leading in Elul leading up to Rosh Hashanah?
Sure. So you start blowing the shofar in the month of Elul, and I think just throwing that out there is good. So I'm glad you raised that, because I think a lot of people associate just shofar with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, but because a lot of people a lot of Jews don't have the tradition of praying daily, which is, many people may not know, three times daily prayer is kind of this the traditional ideal. But in any event, beginning in the month of Elul, in the Shacharit service, in the morning service, following the service, you blow the shofar. So you kind of end the morning davening with the sounding of the shofar. So the shofar in the Torah signifies a bunch of different things. But one of the things that it's connected with is kind of proclaiming the new year. And the shofar can be seen as in a number of ways. One is as a like an alarm. Imagine the sound of a shofar as an alarm waking you up, right? And so there's a passage in our tradition that says, like, awake you sleepers. And so if you can take this ancient phrase and apply it to your own life and imagine, we've all heard the phrase, he's sleepwalking through life. So the idea is the shofar is, even when you're awake, it's supposed to really awaken you. So we're not sleepwalking and we're being reflective about who we are and what we're doing. But the other thing is that the shofar traditionally is like calling us back, reminding us of our people's past or mythical past, depending on how you want to frame it or think about it. We were living together in community, informed by these ideals for how to build the best lives for ourselves in the context of a community, and really living aspirationally as individuals and as a people. And the shofar is this ancient practice that is associated with calling the Jewish people back together and reminding them of what might be. But I'll tell you that the part of blowing the shofar that it just kind of dawned on me one year that this was the case. As I was blowing the shofar, I really was like awestruck, because people may have heard the halakha, the rule, the Jewish law that says when you blow the shofar, it doesn't have a mouthpiece. It's just the horn of an animal, and it can't have anything between your lips and it. Mm-hmm. And what's powerful about that is that you realize, you know, if you were to play it through if you put a trumpet piece, mouthpiece before the shofar, and we were to blow it, it would sound great. It would not sound like what it sounded like 2,000, 3,000 years ago. But I had this moment when I was just blowing it. It's just human flesh and animal horn and nothing else. And it suddenly dawned on me that this is precisely the sound that our ancestors heard, quite literally, precisely the sound. And so there was this moment of like spiritual time travel where, you know, there's a lot about our modern Jewish lives that are not like, you know, obviously how people lived 2,000 years ago or at the time of the Torah 3,000 years ago, because our lives are so attenuated by, modern circumstance. But to have this moment where I realized, wow, this might as well be something, you know, 1,000 BCE, and that same, not only the same sound, but the same human yearning to move beyond where I am now and to come back to something better is just such a beautiful and profound moment. Again, I think with that, regardless of your theology or absence of any theology.
Yeah. So I'm curious how, from Jewish textual tradition, the Song of Songs, this part of Jewish scripture that reads almost like a love poem, in fact, quite a bit like a love poem, is connected to Elul. Where does that stem from, that connection?
Well, so for, let me introduce it by saying this. So the modern word repentance that some people associate with the High Holidays, I mean, I assume most people are familiar with that concept, repentance. That English word is really clumsy and sits very uncomfortably in relationship to Rosh Hashanah. But where it comes from is the Hebrew word is teshuvah. And teshuvah can mean a couple of things. One thing, the simple meaning of teshuvah is answer. It means an answer. But really, the word answer is a response. You're returning, you know, if you, Rockne, ask me a question, I give you a teshuvah, an answer, because I'm returning my part in the conversation. So teshuvah also means to return. The root of it is to return. And so the idea is that we're returning to something. Well, one of the ways that you can see this through a mystical lens, that we're trying to return to our source spiritually. We're trying to return to the perfect unity that once existed when there was no distinction between divinity and anything else. So in the world of the mystics, the whole world is infused with spirituality and with divine light. And so we're trying to return to that because we've become separated from it. One of the metaphors that the rabbis used to talk about that process, that yearning of trying to return to our cleaving to God when we were in like perfect harmony, mm-hmm. Is the love relationship. So the rabbis would imagine the Jewish people and God in the relationship of husband and wife, and that we're seeking our lover. And for some people, that kind of language may be strange or alien. That's not usually how we think about our religious lives. But if you think about standing in a state of separation and wanting to have the most profound unity you can have, what better metaphor is that for a husband and wife coming together in every way, creating a unity out of two? And so the Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is this extended, magnificent love poem that's just astonishing. And here too, I would offer and even request of those other people, Jewish or not, who are not religious, to read Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, if you never have. It is just stunning. And it reads like a love poem between two humans. Mm-hmm. But it's always been understood in the Jewish tradition as a metaphor for the relationship between the individual person or the Jewish people and God. And so this very frank and powerful, passionate language of yearning for your lover and wanting to come together has always been seen as an expression of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. And therefore, you know, Song of Songs fits that. Now, the other piece of it is that the word, the name of the month, Elul, is spelled Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed, which those are the four letters that spell the word Elul, which is the name of the month. And that can also be read as an acronym for Ani Ledodi Vedodi Li, which is a line from the Song of Songs, I am my beloved and my beloved is mine. And so Elul becomes shorthand for this relationship between God and the Jewish people. So it's really like this month of a love affair that leads up to the high holidays. Yeah.
What are some of the other parts of historical Jewish texts that speak to this period of time in the year?
I mean, there's so many books, modern and ancient, that talk about this period of time and this period of self-reflection. I mean, for me, it's always, you know, textually, it's always about, I always look at the Machzor, the month before, and read some of the tefillot, the prayers of the Machzor, so that I can get stirred up and also so kind of have insights into the prayers themselves. There's also a lot of the Hasidic approaches, the Jewish mystical approaches to spiritual preparation are available in English. And so that's something that a lot of people turn to as well. And also there's just a lot of contemporary guides to spiritual preparation. One of my favorite books that is so powerful is written by a modern book, is written by a fellow named Rabbi Alan Liu, who tragically died at far too young. But he wrote a book that I cannot recommend highly enough to whoever is listening, called This Is Real and You Are Completely Unprepared. Have you heard of it?
I actually have, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
It is just such a beautiful and powerful book. He was a great writer, but also a great thinker. And one of the many reasons I love this book is that he takes you through the entire cycle of the high holidays. So starting with Elul and going all the way through to, I don't know if he stops at Sukkot or Shavuot. I think Sukkot. So that you see them all as being of a piece. So a lot of people just think of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur as the high holidays. But he has you think of this entire trajectory, not only as like a way of thinking about the theology, but also your own inner work and the process that we go through as we go on this journey of several weeks from Rosh Hashanah. So that's at the top of my list for books that I like to recommend to people.
Yeah. So as we talked about a little earlier, Kolab's programs, both present and past, have focused on Jewish textual study, and I know it's something you're passionate about personally. And it's, I think it's often seen as almost exclusively a religious practice within Jewish tradition. For folks who are not as religious or don't consider themselves religious or don't have that theological outlook, where can they find value in Jewish textual study?
You know, I actually think this question is so important as to be, I think one of the fundamentally important topics in contemporary Jewish life. And what I mean by that is, I think that for a long time we thought of Jewish people who were not religious as sort of like, you know, people will say things like, well, I'm kind of Jewish, you know, or that person's Jewish-ish, you know, somehow if you didn't buy the theology or you didn't want to go to synagogue, and, you know, God knows, no pun intended, that synagogues are filled with people who don't believe, which is fine. But, you know, the point is that the religious context, the prayer context, I should say, has always been seen as like the measuring stick. But actually, I think that that's totally backwards. I think that really, not that one would have to choose, but for me, Jewish learning is really what is the most essential part of a full life, of a Jewish life. And so here's what I would say to people. I think that, you know, there's a bunch of layers of this to make it approachable. And let me just give like a practical, a kind of theoretical one and then a practical one. The theoretical one is nobody ever reads the Odyssey and says like, oh, well, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to read this. I mean, come on. Who believes in the gods in that way? That's ridiculous. And then that's the end of the conversation, right? Nobody would ever approach the Odyssey in that way. Or, you know, we could name any numbers of books of, you know, classical literature where we would say, well, the religious underpinnings are such that there's just nothing I can get out of this. So that's one thing for people who feel allergic to, like, you know, religious texts in a Jewish context might just think about from a common sense perspective. And that is to say that, you know, it is possible to read religious texts and to not sit well with the theology, but to see it for the beauty that it is and see that it contains wisdom. So I would just say that at a high level. Mm-hmm. The second thing I would say, and then I want to really give some really practical steps. The second thing I would say is that I think that learning anything, whether it's a Jewish text or whether it's a work of philosophy or a novel, if you really want to get something out of a text, you have to diminish yourself a little bit. It requires a little bit of humility. So if you're reading a text from somebody who lived 1,000 years ago, you can't read it in the sense of, well, this author didn't know anything about the world, right? You have to start with like, okay, this person lived in a very different context than I did, and I bet that the fact that they don't live in the modern world, though there's a lot they didn't know, I bet there's a lot they did know that I don't know, that I stand to learn. So I think there's a little bit of humility. But practically speaking, you know what? Studying Jewish texts is a blast, and it's fascinating. One of the reasons it's a blast is that traditionally the way to do it is to study it in a chevruta, which just means like a bond or a friendship or a partnership. It means it's partnered learning. You sit down classically, you would sit down with a text. Let's say we were going to read the Song of Songs together. Mm-hmm. And you'd take a little portion of it and you would read it back and forth to one another and talk about it line by line. There's more to it, but that's kind of the basic idea. It's a necessarily social process, which makes it fascinating, not only more fun than reading alone. Of course, one can read all of this stuff alone, but also you find that a text whose meaning you thought you had nailed down suddenly has all of these other valences you hadn't considered because you're working through another person's consciousness when they say, well, I saw this in it and not that. So Kolab is really, I'm glad you brought this up because Kolab is embracing this idea that Jewish learning is at the heart and at the center, and also embracing the idea that people are hungry for wisdom. Our modern lives are so complicated, and we often really feel this yearning for meaning and guidance on how to navigate life. And so the Jewish tradition has an enormous amount to offer us. So this program, Learning Lab, which I mentioned earlier, we've got, for the month of Elul, we've got 4 nights of really preparation, 4 nights of Elul classes. I would encourage people to just to come and explore. Every one of these teachers is teaching on the assumption that while some of the people who are gathered in the class may be familiar with some of the ideas that they're exploring, a lot of people are coming to this for the first time. And these texts that you may be intimidated by or feel like you have no connection to will really be brought to life by these incredible teachers we have. And this will be a beautiful way in to Rosh Hashanah preparation, to making the high holidays more meaningful. Because every one of the classes is focused on getting ready for Rosh Hashanah in one way or the other. It's a new and very powerful way to approach this period of preparation. And as I said, after September and after the holidays, we'll still have weekly classes. But this is a really great month to explore this and to explore these ideas in a deep way.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask for someone who hasn't done this kind of study before, but who's interested, where does one begin? This sounds like a pretty great way to begin. Are there other easy avenues in for folks who haven't done this before, but might not be? We do have listeners outside of Portland and folks who might not be available during this, what sounds like this really exciting program.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things I would say. So let me just kind of toot my own horn for a second. So one of the programs we offer, CoLab offers something called Jewish Discovery, which is really great, especially for people out of town. So I do one-on-one learning via Zoom with people. And I have, a bunch of courses people can take, or people who say, well, I don't want to study that stuff, but I really would like to study Shabbat a little more, or whatever it might be. And so I do hourly learning with people who are interested. And our website, again, is colabpdx.org. Go to the programs menu and you'll see Jewish Discovery. So that's one way. Also, there is so much material available in English at Sefaria, Sefaria.org. There's just a vast Jewish library of like all of the Jewish sources that have been, not quite all of them, but an astonishingly enormous library is accessible. It's free. People should make a contribution, but it's free. People can engage there. And then there's a lot, CoLab is offering stuff. Unfortunately, besides the individual learning, we don't have all of our classes online yet. We hope to, but there are organizations like Hadar, Hadar.org, others that do incredible learning online. But I would say if none of that resonates, go to your rabbi or go to a rabbi, and I offer myself as a rabbi, and just reach out. I'm Rabbi Josh at colabpdx.org, Rabbi Josh at colabpdx.org, and just say, man, I would love to go a little deeper, or I don't know where to begin, or what do I start? And you can get book titles, recommendations, whatever it might be, and then any number of great books would have footnotes that you can follow up to if you want to read the original sources.
Sounds like a plan. Rabbi Josh Rose, thank you so much for joining us on the Jewish Review Podcast.
Rocky, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
That's all for the Season 2 premiere of the Jewish Review Podcast. Thank you so much to Rabbi Josh Rose for his work and wisdom. You can learn more about the innovative programs CoLab is putting on here in Portland at colabpdx.org. If you like this episode, please leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice to help others find our show. Click subscribe to get our latest episode every 2 weeks, and tell a friend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out by email to editor@jewishportland.org. As a note for returning listeners from Season 1, the podcast will now alternate weeks with editions of the Jewish Review newspaper. Make sure you're getting the latest news from Portland's Jewish community by subscribing to The Review online at jewishportland.org/Jewish Review. The Jewish Review podcast is a production of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Our associate editor is Karone Blau-Rothstein. Special thanks to Daniel Berger. Our theme music is by Isaac Joel. I'm Rockney Roll. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, all the best.